Welcome to ZMO Kitchen Talks, a podcast about historical and anthropological research in the Middle East, Africa, Eurasia, South and Southeast Asia, produced by Leibniz Zentrum Moderner Orient in Berlin. My name is Elisa Nobel-Dilati. I'm a Middle East anthropologist and knowledge transfer officer at ZMO. Over a cup of coffee or tea, I talk to renowned academics about their research questions, regions, and methodologies. We also take a look behind the scenes of academic practice at personal reflections, challenges, failures, and unexpected outcomes. Welcome to a new Kitchen Talk episode. Today we will be talking about artificial intelligence, short AI, in African and Islamic studies. And I'm very happy about my guest today, Frédéric Mador. He's a postdoctoral research fellow at ZMO, working at the intersection of African studies, Islamic studies, and digital humanities. His recent book, Religious Activism on Campuses in Togo and Benin, examines how Christian and Muslim student associations have reshaped university life in Benin and Togo since the 1970s, challenging dominant secular ideologies. He's currently organizing the Volkswagen-funded workshop Charting New Territory, Digital Humanities and AI in African Studies, to be held in February 2026. And I'm very happy to speak with you today. Welcome, Frédéric.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Your work combines traditional historical methods with computational tools. Notably, you've created the Islam West Africa Collection, an open access digital database analyzing Islamic print culture. And for this and other research projects, you've been using AI, the topic we would like to speak about today. So I think I can say that there's a certain skepticism among researchers against AI. Also at ZMO, we've been having several discussions about it. And so maybe as a start, can you name some general fields of research where AI can be used?
Sure. I think AI, especially large language models like ChatGPT or Gemini, has immense potential for the humanities. In many fields, the landscape has changed. We have a growing number or mountain of digitized archives, plus born digital material like websites, social media, photos, and videos. So for many historians and anthropologists, the problem isn't do we have sources anymore. The problem is how do we handle the mess? How do we cope with the sheer volume of it all? So let's maybe look at historians first. I'm a historian by training. Arlette Farge, in her famous book, The Allure of the Archives, talks about the old ideal of research. You know, these slow, tactile encounters with documents, the pleasure of touching the real, you spend days with just a few files. But today, our reality is very different. Research trips are often short and intense. They turn into scanning parties. So you go, you photograph everything you can in a week, and you come home with thousands of images. And you tell yourself, oh yes, when I come back, I will calmly read all of this at my office or at home. But in reality, you skim just a little, and a lot of those scans just sit on a hard drive for years. Time and attention are now our scarce resources. And this is where AI can help, not by replacing our interpretation, but by helping us navigate the overload. Current AI models are already surprisingly good at processing documents at scale. So basically, they do two things well from my experience. First, OCR and layout detection. So AI can transcribe printed and even handwritten text, and it handles complex layout like newspapers. And it also it is also very good at name entity recognition. So it automatically detects people, places, and organization in text. So this makes cataloging much faster. So suddenly, these messy scans you have on your laptop becomes more searchable text. Instead of spending months on manual transcription and keyword taggings, we can spend that time on analysis and writing. So whole collections that were basically unreadable or unsearchable suddenly become accessible. Now, is it perfect? Of course not. And there's a risk. The risk is that we only read summaries or rely on keyword search. We might lose the texture, the contradictions, the gaps that are so important for history. And I also think there's another loss. When you use AI to search a large volume of document, you might find exactly what you ask for. But with the analog way or the work in physical archive or physical documents, you find what you weren't looking for. So you stumble across a strange letter in the wrong folder or a scribbled note in the margin. So my worry is that by making everything more easily searchable, we lose the serendipity of the archive. So we might become more efficient, but less surprise. Now for maybe anthropologists, the obvious use case is really transcribing interviews. Anyone who ever manually transcribed an entire interview has probably questioned their career choice. You spend an entire day just trying to transcribe everything, even if it's just 45 minutes. So current tools can detect different speakers, add timestamps, and even note Lother. And with colleagues at ZMO, we've had very good results in English and French, but also in Arabic and even Hausa, which is a major West African language. So you can get a solid first draft in a fraction of the time. And honestly, it is much less painful to correct an AI transcript than to type out an hour of audio from scratch. But there are clear limits. Accuracy drops depending on accents, recording quality, and background noise. Person names often cause errors. And of course, there are privacy concerns when dealing with sensitive data, which is the case for many of us at ZMO. And I also feel that transcribing manually makes you think about your material much more deeper than just reading a text prepared by someone else. So if I had to sum it up, I would say AI is extremely useful for a tedious task and coping with digital abundance, but it must remain an assistant. Our job is still to read critically and make the ethical choices that the machine simply cannot make.
Yeah, thank you. You already said you're a historian by training and you focus on African and Islamic studies. And one of your big projects has been the Islam West Africa collection that you've been building for some years. It is an open access digital database of over 14,000 archival documents, newspaper articles, Islamic publications, photographs, audio recordings, all relating to Islam and Muslims in West Africa. In this particular project, how did you make use of AI?
So to answer that, I actually need to take you back a bit to around 2013. Back then, these large language models didn't even exist yet. So I was basically operating as a digital hoarder. So beside tennis, my other great passion is simply scanning and organizing things. Ever since my master's degrees, I have been obsessively digitizing thousands of press clippings and Islamic publications from Burkina Faso, Benin, Côte d'Ivoire, and Togo. I also saved thousands of online articles using the Wayback Machine. But at that stage, it was all sitting in Zotero, in a private database just for me. When I decided to make this public, starting with the Islam Burkina Faso collection in 2021, it was a very artisanal approach. I did almost everything by hand. So I was correcting the optical character recognition errors manually. I was typing in the metadata for every single document. In 2023, I was lucky enough to have a student assistant for a few months, and we spent countless hours tagging people, topics, and places, and sometimes arguing whether that specific keyword was relevant or not. So that worked fine for a few hundred of documents, but the collection exploded to several thousands of items. So to give you a sense of the scale, the collection has now crossed 26 million of words. This is the equivalent of more than 300 books. And I still have thousands of documents on my hard drive waiting to be added to the database. And remember, I'm doing this mostly alone. I'm the historian, but I'm also the IT guy managing the server. So I hit a wall. It is physically impossible to process the amount of information manually. And that is the moment AI had to enter in the project. So I use it in a few ways. First, simply to process the files. So I run the newspaper scan through the AI to extract the text. This makes decades of material actually searchable instead of being locked inside PDFs and images. Second, I also use generative AI to suggest metadata. So the AI read the text and suggests names, mosque, Islamic associations, and keywords. So this allows me to link documents across the 26 million words. But beyond this processing work, I also try a more provocative experiment. So I wanted to see how West African newspapers talk about Islam and Muslims over time. Instead of manually coding thousands of articles, which would take months, I asked two different AI models to analyze about 12,000 articles. So I asked the AI to rate three specific things. First, is the portrayal positive or negative? Is it factual or opinionated? And how central is Islam to the story? So the whole process cost about 15 euros and finished in one day. So this is astonishing compared to traditional methods. So I built an interactive dashboard where you can explore these scores. It lets us triage this massive amount of data so we can spot extreme opinions or contradictions quickly. And if something looks surprising, you can jump straight back to into the original article to check it. But the crucial point here is consistency. Think about it, as a human, naturally you'll get tired after reading a few hundred of articles. But it's not just about fatigue or mood, it's about how you read. The way you annotate a text changes over time because you are influenced by what you have already read. So by article number 5000, your definition shifts. You start comparing the text in front of you with the one you read an hour ago. So your criteria drift. But in that experiment, the AI doesn't have that memory biases. It treats article number 50 exactly the same way as article number 5000. So now, obviously, I'm very aware of the risk. Models have biases. They can miss irony or local culture nuances. This is why interpretation, that has to remain a human task. So the AI helps me to see the patterns, but I still have to do the close reading to understand why those patterns exist.
Yeah, interesting. You said that the project began in 2013. Now, could you tell us how the technology has changed over these years, especially with the rise of generative AI and the appearance of ChatGPT in late 2022?
Yes, over the last 3 years, the change have been huge. First, I would say there's the quality of the models. Take OCR, text recognition. Traditional tools were built for tidy, rectangular documents like books or letters. If you gave them a newspaper with different columns, headlines, photos, and captions, they got completely confused. But now we have so-called multimodal AI models, so they can process text, images, audio, and video all at once. So the AI can literally see the page. I'm using big scary quote here. It understands that an article starts here, jump over a photo, and continues on the next column. So for historians working with newspapers like myself, this is a game changer. And then there's the question of capability. We are seeing a shift from simple chatbots to so-called autonomous agents. So these systems can plan and execute tasks in several steps, sometimes running for minutes to complete a job, like writing software or conducting research online with very little human help. So you actually hear one phrase repeated a lot in the tech world right now, that these models have reached so-called PhD-level intelligence. So obviously, there is a lot of marketing hype in that kind of statement, but it does reflect a certain reality. These autonomous agents are getting surprisingly good in specific fields. If you define PhD level as doing the heavy lifting, like cleaning messy data, running statistical analysis, or drafting Python code, then yes, they are starting to perform like a competent graduate student. But they also share some of the typical weaknesses of a grad student. They can get confused, they can be overconfident about things that they don't actually know. And they still definitely need the PhD supervisor who can guide and check it. Another major evolution is the cost and accessibility. Prices have dropped dramatically. Roughly speaking, processing a text is about 400 times cheaper now than it was with the early models in 2023. So this means that for humanities project, using AI is no longer an expensive experiment. It's something that we can actually afford. And we now have lightweight open source models. Countries like China have pushed hard on this front. So you can run these surprisingly capable models on a university server or even a powerful personal computer without an internet connection. So you don't always need to send your data to a commercial cloud. And this is crucial for privacy and for institutions with limited budget. And finally, and most excitingly, I would say, for the field of digital humanities, the barriers to entry in coding have vanished. We are reaching a point where you can basically code in English, in French, or in German. You don't need to be a programmer anymore. You can just describe what you want in natural language. Take these documents in that folder, extract the text, extract the locations, and then put them on a map. And the AI assistant actually helps you write the script to do it. And there's actually a term for this popping up now, vibe coding. It's a bit of a buzzword, but the core idea is powerful. So you stop worrying about the strict grammar of syntax of a programming language. Instead, you use, as I said, plain English, French, to describe the outcome you want. You are guiding the behavior of the program, not fighting with the semicolons. And this is exactly how a wannabe digital humanist like me can build complex data visualization. I am not typing the code myself, line by line, but I'm managing the reasoning behind the code. So I would say it's truly democratizing. It allows, for example, colleagues based in African institutions where well-funded digital humanities centers are rare, to build their own tools without needing a degree in computer science. And we are even seeing this in teaching. Some historians, for example, argue that we should stop fearing AI and start using it for historical simulation in the classroom. So we can build interactive apps, video games, or historical scenarios using simple prompts. But of course, there's a danger. If we just accept the code without understanding it, that is risky. So we can automate the coding, but we can never outsource our methodological choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, speaking of dangers, have you encountered any threats while using AI, like hallucinations that led to wrong results, or even maybe Islamophobic cliches that AI reproduced? Do you have some examples from your own research?
Yeah, absolutely. I would group the risk into mainly three categories: hidden errors, biases, and people pleasing. Let's start with the errors. We often call them hallucinations. You know, everyone has heard about ChatGPT inventing fake academic citations and references. But when you are doing OCR on historical text, it's much trickier. Since I'm dealing with newspapers, which are often poorly preserved or just non-professional scans, I didn't the scans myself with a not very good cell phone camera in the early 2010s, I've started calling this the seductive danger of clean text. Here's the problem. These AI models are obsessed with fluency. They want to write smooth sentences. So if the AI sees a blurry word or a hole in the paper, it doesn't stop. It often fills the gap. It invents a word that fits the context, so the result looks perfectly plausible. And that changes the nature of the error entirely. With traditional OCR technology, if it failed, you saw garbage, hashtags, random symbols, broken letters. So it's a transparent failure. You look at it and you knew immediately, okay, this is completely broken. But with AI, because it's so smooth, it becomes a hidden fabrication. We are moving from errors that are obvious to errors that are designed to be kind of invisible. And that demands a totally different level of vigilance from the historian. So I try to mitigate this by asking the AI to mark uncertain words or use brackets when the text is unreadable, but it's not bulletproof. Then there's the question of bias that you mentioned. Obviously, these models are trained on Western data. They see way more English than Hausa or Swahili. However, regarding the sentiment analysis experiment I mentioned earlier, I was actually surprised by the result. I expected the AI to rate articles about terrorism and jihadism in the Sahel negatively regarding Islam. But instead, it often gave them very positive ratings. So when I dug into it, I saw that the AI had rightly pointed out a key distinction. It correctly identified when the text separated violent extremism from the actual Islamic doctrine, which is about peace and tolerance. So in that specific case, the AI was actually quite nuanced. However, or on a more general level, there's a different risk. You ask about Islamophobic cliché, but often I observe the opposite extreme. These models can become almost overly polite or apologetic. Because they are trying so hard to give a non-offensive answer, they sometimes downplay genuinely hostile discourse. And this brings us to the problem of opacity. We simply don't know what is going on behind the scenes. We don't know exactly how they fine-tune the model. Is it just being overly polite? Is it being apologetic to avoid controversy? We are guessing. And on top of that, these models are non-deterministic. If I feed the exact same newspaper page into the system twice, I might get slightly different transcription or analysis each time. And as we know, reproducibility is the very foundation of scientific research. And the third category I mentioned is sycophancy, or basically people-pleasing. The problem is that these models are trained to be liked. The AI companies want the models to please the user. So now we see a growing number of people using AI to kind of outsource their judgment, asking it to critique their ideas, or for social scientists, maybe acting as a reviewer on my paper. But several studies show that AI chatbots often just mirror your views. They don't challenge you, they act like a yes man. And there was actually a perfect example of this recently with OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT. They pushed an update that accidentally made the model overly flattering. So users noticed it immediately. It was praising everything, agreeing with bad ideas, and mirroring people's opinions. And OpenAI actually had to admit the models had become sycophantic and rolled the update back. But here's the twist. When they release a newer, more logical model, one that was smarter but maybe a bit colder, users got upset. So people describe it as losing a friend, they miss the flattery. So you see, this shows how deeply we project relationship onto those machines. And for a researcher, this is dangerous. If the system is trained to keep you happy, it becomes a mirror rather than a source of genuine critical judgment. And as social scientists, we don't need a flattering cheerleader, we need a critic. And maybe finally, a fourth element I should briefly mention, I can't finish without mentioning the environmental cost. Running these huge models burn massive amounts of energy and water. So we always have to ask ourselves, do I really need a heavy AI tool for this task? Or is a lighter, maybe more sustainable approach enough? We need to aim for a bit more digital sobriety, or so-called minimal computing.
Yeah, also really important point. You mentioned earlier that the digitization of sources can be significantly sped up by AI. But where do you see challenges? Or maybe I can say it differently. What is left out because it is not digitally accessible?
That's a good question. AI can speed up digitization, yes. But my fear is that it will also sharpen the existing inequalities in what we see and what we study. The most basic point is this. These tools only work on material that has already been digitized. But many archives on the African continent still hold kilometers of unscanned newspapers, administrative records, and private collections. If the scanner never reaches those shelves, then from the perspective of AI, that history might as well not exist. And we also have to talk about the infrastructure problem. AI is software, not hardware. It doesn't solve the issues of storage and sustainability facing many institutions in the global south. You can scan a document, sure, but you need servers, electricity, and maintenance to keep that digital file alive. AI helps us process the data, but it doesn't build the servers to host it. Now, for the things that are scanned, AI can actually be a huge help. Right now, vast amounts of material are just dumped online as PDFs or images. They have no text recognition or very bad extracted text and bad metadata. So in theory, they are accessible, but in practice, they are invisible, so you can search them. And AI is great at fixing this. It can turn those dumb images into searchable text. But here is the big trap, I think. I worry that AI will intensify our tendency to stay in the digital comfort zone. Even before AI, many researchers gravitated towards the well-scanned collections, simply because they were easier to find. Now, with AI making those collections even easier to analyze, the temptation is stronger than ever. But we have to remember, digitization is selective. What gets scanned in Africa usually reflects the priorities of Western funding agencies. If we only follow what is easy to process with AI, we risk mistaking these selected archives for a complete history. And meanwhile, equally important archives remain unscanned and therefore absent. And finally, there is the language question. Most large language models work best in Western languages. They still struggle with African national languages and even with Arabic in some contexts. So even if the material is digitized, if it's not in a dominant language, the AI can leave it behind.
Yeah, thank you for sharing all of these thoughts and your own experiences also in this fast-changing field. Before we come to an end, I would like to look into the future. How do you see the future relationship between AI and research in the humanities?
I see the future as both fascinating and a bit frightening. It is frightening because, for example, a recent study by Microsoft researchers ranked historians as one of the professions most exposed to AI. Apparently, we are second only to translators. So there are even some provocative predictions calling us the last generation of historians. That certainly fuels anxiety about being replaced, and especially in fields that are already precarious. But I think the realistic scenario isn't replacement. It isn't a binary choice. It is a new division of labor. To put it simply, to the AI, the scale, to the human, the depth. We should use AI to augment rather than automate our work. AI is great at the first pass. It can clean text, flag patterns across thousands of pages with a consistency that no exhausted student assistant can match. That frees us in principle to do what historians do best, contextualize, question the categories, read against grain, and craft narratives that make sense. So AI is the assistant, not the historian, at least for now. However, there's a trap. We live in a publish or perish system. If everyone has tools that speed up writing and data processing, there's a risk that institutions and funders will just expect more output rather than better work. We already have more publication than anyone can read. Finding peer reviewers has already become incredibly difficult. My worry is that AI creates a kind of a productivity race, a flood of marginally original papers instead of giving us more time for slow thinking and deeper archival work. I also believe AI literacy will become a core skill for us. I don't mean everyone becomes a computer scientist or a programmer, but researchers need to remain in control. We need to treat prompts and AI model choices like any other methodology. So like we cite archival material, we will have to document which model did I use, what prompt did I give it. So this is part of research ethics now. And maybe a final crucial dimension is equity, especially in African context. If nothing changes, AI will just make it easier to work with sources in Western languages. Meanwhile, manuscript and oral histories in Hausa, Wolof, Ewe, or Yoruba will remain invisible. So in an optimistic scenario, AI could help African libraries process those uncatalogued collections that have been sitting in boxes for decades. but that requires investment in local capacity. And we also need to talk about data sovereignty and data colonialism. Right now, there is a risk of a new kind of extractivism. We take African historical data, feed it into models owned by giant American corporations to produce knowledge about Africa. So that is why we must advocate strongly for open source local AI models. We need to ensure that the infrastructure of memory remains in the hands of the communities produced it, not just in a data center in California, for example. So in conclusion, I think AI will change how we work in academia. There is no way around it, whether you like it or not. The real question is, will we as social scientists help shape these tools? Or we will simply adapt those tools built for someone else? And I think historians are well positioned to do this. Our training focuses on patterns of marginalization and silence. We are trained to read against the grain, and that is exactly how we should treat AI.
Yeah, thank you. I think we know now that you're a historian who will actively shape AI. Thank you for sharing all these insights and for taking the time to come to our kitchen talks.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.